This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
Cincinnati Garden sitting out there big as day. Open that up, renovate it, soccer. Spring Grove, where the old Cons building is, it's just sitting there, all that land. You have plenty of land, plenty of parking, whatever. Soccer. Leave Taft alone.
The Cincinnati School Board hears from West End residents opposed to FC Cincinnati's plan to build a new soccer stadium near Taft High School. And how often does this happen? A government agency finds $8 million extra dollars. That's how much the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority recently discovered. City Council member Amy Murray is troubled.
I don't have confidence right now in the financial system that SORTA is using, so I really think that you need to address that to the public and to council of what happened and how that is being fixed, because this shouldn't be happening.
Also on today's news review, the issue of jail overcrowding resurfaces. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us first, WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz. Amanda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you guys, too.
WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Cincinnati Inquirer regional politics reporter Scott Wortman. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
And WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman.
Good afternoon.
And let's start with the debate over FC Cincinnati's plans for a new soccer stadium. Amanda, this week, FC Cincinnati General Manager Jeff Birding made a presentation to the Cincinnati School Board about plans for the team's new soccer stadium. So tell us about what's being proposed here.
Yeah, so we had kind of been thinking for a long time that he was very interested in Stargell Stadium in the West End. It's the stadium that several high school sports used to play games on, and he confirmed basically that that's what this partnership is that he's interested in with Cincinnati Public Schools on Monday, that he would like to do a land swap of sorts. So he would take the vacant land that was plotted for Cityrama and build a new high school stadium. He's estimating about $10 million on that land. And then FC Cincinnati would build their soccer stadium on the current high school stadium's land.
Bill, where exactly is Stargell Stadium? Where's that sit?
It is along Central Avenue, just north of Taft High School, which is on Ezra Charles. It's in the West End. If you think about Central Parkway, if you go over about two blocks west from Central Parkway and a couple blocks south from Liberty, that's where it is.
Amanda, what kind of reaction did this proposal get from the school board?
Well, the school board really hasn't been vocal about where they stand on this issue. The thing that they've been most vocal about throughout this process is saying that they are committed to community engagement and making this process transparent. We didn't see a lot of reaction from the school board on Monday. I don't think they were totally surprised by the offer. I think that they probably had a hunch that this is what was coming. But what we did see a lot of reaction from was people speaking, public speakers, at the meeting on Monday. We sat through close to 2 hours, if not 2 hours, of public comment, most of which was very strong negative reaction to the idea of A, building in the West End a soccer stadium, and B, taking the high school stadium to build on for a new soccer stadium.
So, Bill, what about people? I mean, of course, they got reaction from people opposed to this. Was there anybody telling them, hey, this isn't such a bad idea?
There were surprisingly few FC Cincinnati supporters at the school board meeting. That kind of surprised me. In previous government engagements talking about where to put a stadium, FC Cincinnati supporters have turned out en masse with banners and their scarves, blue and orange. I only saw three people in the entire room Monday night with any kind of FC Cincinnati garb on them, not counting Jeff Birding. Two of them got up and spoke. One was, you know, I would really like this deal to go through, but I understand if it doesn't. The other one was a little more, he was in favor of it. I would like to point out a Cincinnati Public Schools spokesperson said 600 people tuned in to watch live streaming of the event, so I'm guessing that's where all the supporters were.
And that's a lot more than they usually get, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amanda, how definite is it that the new stadium would be built in the West End?
Well, there's still a lot of ifs here. The first being, obviously, if FC Cincinnati gets an MLS bid. So we're still waiting on that. We're told that it'll be at the end of this month that an announcement will be made. So that's the first if. The second is that FC Cincinnati general manager Jeff Birding and then former Cincinnati mayor Mark Mallory, who has been working on outreach in the West End, they've been very clear this week that if the community doesn't want this stadium, if they get an overwhelming sense that they're not going to be welcome there, then they've said that they're going to build elsewhere. But I definitely think that FC Cincinnati has a very strong interest in this site. I don't think that they would be doing this type of outreach, sitting through the negative public comments that they've got over the last couple weeks, if they weren't very serious about this site.
Jay?
Amanda, isn't the Mallory family even split on this too, that Mark's on one side and his brother is on the other side?
Yeah, we saw his brother Joe on Monday give some pretty searing comments about the plan. It sounded like he had sat down with Jeff Birding and was really critical of, A, how transparent the process, or how not transparent the process had been, and B, just, it was really talking about a lot of skepticism as to how this whole stadium plan would benefit the West End. And he also was holding up some signs, too, when Mark Mallory was speaking to the residents during the West End Community Council on Tuesday.
One thing I thought, too, in the opening soundbite we heard when the show started, we heard the guy mention the possibility of the Cincinnati Garden site. I would assume that site is probably not urban enough for what MLS is searching for. But one thing I hadn't thought about, what about the Conn site?
I think that's also probably a little bit away from the urban core that MLS has said is a big part of this. MLS wants a stadium, soccer-specific stadium, in the heart of a city. And Queensgate, you know, up there, Camp Washington area, not quite heart of the city.
And he hasn't ruled out Oakley yet, has he?
Oakley is still on the table, and Jeff Birding said they are still talking to the owners of the Ovation site in Newport.
But the Lindners, though, they haven't budged on their resistance to go out of state.
No.
Across the river.
Yeah, and I do think, too, I would question how much, I mean, on one hand, Nashville, the site that they have picked for the stadium, it's not super urban. But I do wonder how, if Oakley is really urban enough for the MLS. Just based on research we've done, the MLS has kind of picked a lot of sites recently that are very similar to the West End. They're looking to build sites. Orlando is one of them. Miami is one of them, in very urban core neighborhoods. And a lot of neighborhoods, too, that are kind of underprivileged and might benefit from some revitalization as well.
Amanda, you've done some looking into the possible benefits and problems if this stadium is built in the West End. What could happen if the stadium is built in the West End neighborhood?
Well, yeah, I think that's the big kind of question that everyone has on their mind right now. The top concern that I've heard about a stadium coming is people just being priced out of their homes. There's a lot of renters in the West End. So if property values start going up, if rent starts going up, there's some really serious concern about how that would impact residents that live there and if they would be able to stay in their homes. So that's just hands down what I've heard is the biggest concern from people living there.
Yeah, there's concerns about the historic nature being affected as well, aren't there?
Yeah, people don't want to see, I mean, this is a very historical neighborhood. People don't want to see buildings toppled for stadium parking garages, for example, or, that sort of thing. So that's why it's going to be very interesting to see if we do get to a point where what council has asked, Cincinnati City Council has asked for, is a community benefits agreement be written up. So it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of details and what kind of demands that the community might be making if the stadium does go there. So is it affordable housing, for example? Do they get a grocery store out of this deal, for example? That's kind of what we'll be watching over the next couple weeks.
Scott?
From FC Cincinnati's standpoint, it makes the Newport option all the more interesting because all the buildings on that site have been demolished for a highway project and it's completely vacant. And every resident I've talked to on that side would welcome I've not heard any opposition to a stadium being put over there, but it seems to be still the third option for the team.
And I think
you do have to wonder, does it look better every day, Newport?
Yeah.
Jay?
The community benefits agreement, I think there's a pretty good chance that we're going to hear some more about that at the Budget and Finance Committee meeting coming up on Tuesday at Cincinnati City Hall. So there might be some more details that we'll learn on Tuesday.
And Amanda, what do they see as being the main benefit of this if this goes into the West End?
The main benefit I've heard from FC Cincinnati leaders in particular is that this is really a chance to let the West End shine, to bring in some of the retail that West End residents say that they would really like to see. So I talked to West End residents who said, we've wanted a laundromat for years. So maybe this is an opportunity to get that and also to bring in jobs for West End residents. I talked to the community council president who said a lot of people have to go to Kentucky or travel pretty far, commute pretty far to their job. So this could be possibly a chance to change that tide.
And a number of people, a theme I was hearing Monday night was people referring back to the building of the interstate and the destruction of the West End neighborhood from that and from other projects. They're saying a lot of that work pushed out the traditional African-American neighbors who were there, and they say the neighborhood never really recovered. And they're afraid that a soccer stadium will do that again. Prices, home prices will go up, and people who live there now won't be able to afford to live there.
And I think it's going to be interesting, too, if some of the reports that we've heard overnight are correct. We've had all this angst about selecting a stadium site in Cincinnati, and
if MLS
goes back to Sacramento, we've had this whole discussion maybe for naught because there's not going to be an MLS stadium in Cincinnati to start with.
And there's a report now that the Sacramento team is making some headway on getting another billionaire investor, which would be a huge boost to their effort.
And then I think I heard something and there was a report also this morning that perhaps that's why MLS is dragging their feet, is to let Sacramento secure that new investor, and then that's where the other expansion team is going to end up.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Yeah, that just seems to be Sacramento's biggest holdup, is getting someone who can really pay for this venture for years to come. And it will be really interesting to see how the MLS reacts if Sacramento does get that big billionaire investor. I think that puts Cincinnati in a very tough spot.
Amanda and Bill, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPU. Thanks. Oh, go ahead, Amanda. Sorry.
Oh, I just said thanks.
Okay. WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. So, Scott, the Hamilton County Sheriff holds press conference this week to talk about the county jail. So what's his message?
Yeah, he brought in all the media, all the TV stations into a cell block there. And basically, he wanted to put pressure on the county leaders and the state government to say, hey, I need more jail space. We're bursting at the seams, which from a reporting standpoint, it's not unusual. Everywhere I've covered, there's never been a jail where, like, we got plenty of room. I don't know what to do with all this.
And this is an issue that's come up several times with the Hamilton County Jail as well.
Particularly the last 10 years, because of the recession, they closed the Queensgate facility, which was 800 beds, almost the same size as what the Justice Center is designed to hold. The Justice Center is designed to hold 840 prisoners, but because they don't have anywhere else to put them, they are at 1,400 right now, which is what they can max out at. But he's afraid by this summer they're going to have 1,900 or more, which he said is just it's not possible.
Why are we getting this overcrowded situation? What's going on?
Well, a lot of factors, and it kind of depends on who you ask. Heroin's a big issue. It's not unprecedented that you'd have drug problems, though. It's not really the only issue. It's the most popular answer that a lot of elected people will give. But there are a lot of different factors. One is the state budget that was passed last year. The state wanted to save money because they don't want to house prisoners. So low-level felons, fifth-level felonies will be, as of July, the responsibility of counties. And that's going to add, according to the jailer, another 300 prisoners that he wouldn't have had, that the county's never been responsible for before. So that's going to add 300 on top of what he expects will be a boost in the summer months, which always comes. So it would bring the Justice Center well over double what it's even designed to hold.
So the sheriff doesn't see this getting any better.
Yeah. he doesn't know what to do with them all.
So he's proposing what? Reopening Queensgate?
Yes. He said he's open to any other options if they want to build another facility, but he sees that as the most feasible option. But
does the county still own
Queensgate? No, the county, actually, it's kind of an odd situation. When they built where they renovated, it used to be an old hardware warehouse, Cruzy Hardware,
yeah, exactly.
25 years ago. In 93, when they wanted to build that to put extra prisoners, they contracted with a private prison firm out of Nashville, and they didn't run it. The private firm didn't run it, but they owned the property. They bought the property, and they renovated it for the county so the county could save money, and they still own it.
And I think what the other thing, that this is a new old problem. I go way back. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure that the Justice Center wasn't too small when it was brand new and first opened. And as you'll recall, it's been through federal lawsuits that it was over capacity. And in fact, I think those caps are still in place.
Yes.
From that federal lawsuit that they have to limit, even though it is overcrowded, but there's even a limit.
It's even over that limit. The cap was 1,200, and as of Wednesday, they were at 1,422.
So what are some of the alternatives? If not Queensgate, what are some of the other things that could be done?
It's brought up the debate on what do you do with these prisoners? Do we incarcerate more people and build more cells, or do we change how we look at criminal justice? And you have a lot of – in the wake of the sheriff's press blitz this week, you have a lot of public defenders. They had a press conference today in front of the courthouse. Public defenders and defense attorneys – calling for bail reform, which would be basically changing how the judges allocate which prisoners get bail and which ones they release on their own recognizance. So you don't have as many people in the jail awaiting trial. Because most of those 1,400 in the jail right now are awaiting trial. They're not even convicted of anything at this point.
The commissioners had a forum this week talking about the budget and how bad it's going to be for next year. Is there even the money in the county budget, even if they wanted to open Queensgate back up? Can they even afford to open that jail back up?
Well, the commissioner said we're open to it, but it doesn't that's a serious question. I mean, just to buy the facility back would be – it's on the market right now for $1.2 million. So if they wanted to do that, they'd have to come up with the $1.2 million just to buy the facility. And Commissioner Todd Portune told me that when the commission closed that, the county closed that in 2008, it wasn't in good shape to begin with.
I was going to ask, is it turnkey? What else would have to happen for this to reopen?
Well, they don't know yet. They are doing a facilities – the county is looking at all the potential facilities for a variety of different services, and the Queensgate facility is one of them. The owner of the property, the private prison firm, wouldn't let us on the site, so we don't know, you know, how good of a condition it's in. The realtor told me that it has a new roof on it, so they got a new roof. But beyond that, the county leaders don't know what condition it's in. But evidently, when it closed, and this was all the reporting that was done 10 years ago, it wasn't in good shape.
And I think the politics here are interesting, too, that you have a Democratic majority on the county commission and a Democratic sheriff. And normally you would call press conferences when you had competing parties that maybe weren't willing or to listen to each other or to work together. But here you've got a Democratic sheriff and a Democratic commission, and they're still kind of using the court of public opinion to try to solve this problem.
Well, there's been friction between the sheriff and the county leaders since the Sheriff Jim Neal took office, because he has consistently run over budget by millions of dollars. And that's caused a lot of leaders to chafe at, you know, how he's run the operation. And so there's some of that friction going on right now.
Yeah, and I think, Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, but last time the issue of jail overcrowding came up, it was attached to the idea of a tax levy to help pay for a new facility.
Actually, I think there have been two tax levies.
Yeah.
2 years in a row, 2006 and 2007, and the voters overwhelmingly like, no, we're not paying more.
Is that a possibility again that we might see that happen?
Actually, no one's mentioned that. I don't think they're going to try that again. I mean, it was pretty emphatic 2 years in a row, but it wasn't even close.
And I think there were two ways that went. One time it was put on the ballot and turned down. And then the commissioners, I believe, hopefully I got this right, I think they imposed it and then – folks made it a referendum, and it went down just by the same 2-1 margin.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've not heard anyone propose that. And considering the number of tax levies that either will already be on the ballot this year and next year and some that are asking to be on the ballot, I don't think there's really much will to ask for a tax increase for this.
So what's next in this whole thing?
Well, the commission said that they're looking, and they've asked the state government for $2.5 million to retrofit the jail for heroin treatment beds for prisoners, because that is what, more than any other single cause, the spike in heroin use is seen as one of the biggest factors for why there are so many prisoners now. It's not the only factor, but it's one that they feel that they can take a bite out of. So they're going to wait till this spring to see what the General Assembly will give them as far as that. And then they will, I mean, the Queensgate facility, the commissioner said, is on the table. They will look at it. But whether it's cost feasible and whether it's the answer, the sheriffs think so, but no one else really is convinced.
Jay, the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority, they found an extra $8 million in
surprise!
Their budget. You asked the perfect question in the story you wrote about this. How often do you see a government agency do something like that?
It doesn't happen very often. From all indications, there's nothing nefarious here. It was basically what happened. There was money that was maybe used.
It was allocated for something else, right?
It was used for a project, and perhaps, you know, they had allocated $200,000 for that project, and they only ended up spending $100,000. So there was an extra $100,000 floating around on the balance sheet. There could have been projects that they funded that didn't end up happening, so that money was there. And apparently, governments like Cincinnati and most governments will do what they call a sweep of those funds and return them to the source so that, you know, that revenue is there. And apparently, SORTA had never really done a review of its balance sheet. And for the last year, they've been auditing the balance sheet. And surprise, they found $7.9 million.
Oh, so it wasn't exactly $7.9 million. Okay.
Broadcasters, we round. It's close enough to $8
million. Okay. So, good news. They found $8 million. But what's been the reaction to this?
Well, I think there was embarrassment and somewhat outrage that this, you know, you could find. I mean, I think the number has a lot to do with that. If it were like $8,000 or $800,000 even, it'd probably be a little easier to tolerate. But $8 million is quite a sum to not have track of on your balance sheet. They plan to essentially split it in half, use half of the money to buy some new buses, which they desperately need because of the aging fleet. And then at this point, they're also talking about putting about $4 million into their reserve accounts. But that, as far as if it was a magic bullet to fix SORTA's budget problems, it's not going to be a magic bullet to fix those problems.
And it's not going to help. They're looking for a sales tax increase, and this is not a good way to pitch one.
Yes, yeah. The opposite. And they're also asking for, I think, is it a 15-cent fare increase?
Yeah.
Which that the optics of that aren't very good either.
Scott, have they ever come to a conclusion on how much that sales tax increase is going to be, how much they're going to ask for on that?
I mean, and not that I haven't seen anything.
There's like three options, like a half a cent, three quarters of a cent, and a full cent, but they've not made up their mind.
But with the commissioners trying to stack the board to delay any tax increase this year, I mean, they don't have the majority, as we discussed, but I don't know if they're going to be able to get a tax increase on this year. It doesn't look likely, but I mean— Well, I could be surprised.
Let's talk about the shuffling that's going on the SORTA board.
Yes.
Now the SORTA board represents what? It's the city and the county, right?
Yeah. The city, the mayor appoints seven members with a consent of council, and the Hamilton County commissioners appoint six, and three of those six come from outlying counties: Warren, Butler, and Claremont County.
So we had Mayor Cranley had somebody he wanted to place on the board, and that got rejected this week, right? 6-3, if I remember the vote right.
Mayor Cranley had appointed Rayshawn Mack to be on the SORTA board, and this week council rejected that 6-3. Most of those opposed. Mr. Mack is pretty outspoken on Twitter, and I think that those some of his comments, that even though he says he takes responsibility for those comments, that was just enough discomfort for a council majority to turn down his appointment.
What kind of comments in particular
about? He's very opinionated on politics. Apparently he's also, and I've not seen this one, but apparently I'm told that he's been critical of the streetcar. And of course, Metro is charged by the city to operate the streetcar. And there was just enough discomfort there with some of the things that had been posted that the council wasn't willing to go along, even though he is a regular bus rider.
I believe he was calling out specific council members, criticizing them, and the people that blocked the nominee felt that that would impede his ability to work with the city leaders.
So what happens next? Mayor has to pick somebody else and put him up for a vote?
Pick another person to fill that slot.
Careful what you tweet.
And meantime, Scott, as you're saying, we have, what, six new appointees on the county side?
Yeah, and Commissioner Todd Portune, the commission president, said he expects them to delay any tax increase being put on the ballot until sort of what he wants. And as a resident, having grown up here, I can say that a lot of people have wished for this. Transit that can go that can take people, like, for instance, from Middletown to the airport somewhere. Because if you're out of the urban core, the knock on this area has been that it's hard to get from point A to point B. And he wants to see a plan from SORTA and establish a regional transit authority that can maybe come up with ways to improve public transit in the outskirts.
And, I mean, his line is he wants a three-state, eight-county solution. Where that runs into a problem, he also wants a three-state, eight-county funding system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be awful difficult to pull off.
We still got
to
get the Brent Spence Bridge before you can get – and that's – yeah, it's not easy going across the river.
And what's your latest prediction on that? 30 years out maybe?
Yeah, 30, 40. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I'm just hoping that they don't start construction until I'm retired.
Oh, yeah.
Jay, thanks so much.
I may make it.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman and Cincinnati Inquirer regional politics reporter Scott Wortman. Joining me now, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Good afternoon, Ryland.
Hi, Mark.
And political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader, Daniel DeRocher.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Good. Thank you. And you can join us by emailing talk at WVXU.org or finding us on Facebook or Twitter. Ryland, we've been hearing repeatedly that a bill to fix Kentucky's pension system for state employees is on the way. Has it finally arrived?
It hasn't arrived yet. Last we've heard, it's going to drop next week. They keep on kind of extending the deadline on when this bill is going to happen. We do have some hints on what will be in the new pension proposal. So the last time around, the big thrust of it is that it's going to move most future and some current workers onto 401k style retirement plans. This one, we've heard, is not going to have the 401k proposal, but it sounds like some employees, including possibly teachers, might be put into what's called a hybrid cash balance system, in which they would still have some sort of defined benefit, meaning they're, it's not like their retirement wouldn't solely be based on, the amount of money that they put into an account, they and their employers put into account, during their working year. So the state would continue to, guarantee a defined amount of money, after retirement as well until death.
So, Daniel, it sounds like maybe that's a bit more of a secure system than the 401k would be.
So the way that they see it, so this is something that they actually did in 2013 as well. They moved state workers into this plan, but they kept teachers out of it. And the way they see it is a 401k style plan would end up costing the state money both in the short term and the long term, whereas this hybrid cash balance plan would not. And there's kind of wonky details behind it. I don't know if you want me to go into that, but basically they see this as something that could be a long term cost saving measure. And it wouldn't work that way if you had a 401k style plan.
Yeah, we kept hearing that they were going to release something this week. So, what are your thoughts on how long this is taking for them to get this bill out?
So the party line is basically they're waiting for actuarial analysis, waiting for numbers back, so that when they present this plan, they can say, look, this is how much it will save, or this is how much it will cost, this is why we're doing this, and they'll have all the numbers behind it so that they can defend it. There was a weird kind of situation this week where there was this rumor going around that the Senate was going to drop a bill either on Wednesday or Thursday, and the House leadership had no idea about that. And so we're not really sure where that miscommunication came in, whether or not the Senate and the governor are impatient with the House and wanted to get a bill out sooner and wanted to kind of put pressure on them so that they pulled the trigger. But really now everybody's on the same page. They're all saying Tuesday, that we're going to see a bill on Tuesday. and it might be dropped in both the Senate and the House at the same time so that they can try and fast-track it and get it through the system faster.
So Tuesday, is that a guaranteed thing?
For the first time, we're actually, like, hearing, like, yes, this is a date when we are going to drop it. So, we're all prepared for this thing to come on Tuesday. There have been dates suggested. They've been saying, oh, yeah, it could be as early as Monday. It could be as early as this date. And now they're actually saying, like, we're going to do it this day, I think, right? Am I wrong, Ryland?
I still haven't heard the specific Tuesday date, but I've heard next week. That's what I heard from Senator Damon Thayer this morning. It'll happen sometime next week.
And Ryland, excuse me just a second, but we're getting some bleed through because I know you're both in the same room today. You're both in Frankfurt today. So if there's any way you can kind of put some distance in there so we get less bleed through. But let's see here. How's that sound now?
It'd be a little better now.
Okay, go ahead.
Just another note on the kind of political ramifications of this. It's just tinkering with pensions is a very politically fraught thing, especially here in Kentucky, where state government is the largest employer in the state. And and I think that's another reason why it's taken so long for this pension bill to come out. Lawmakers are worried about the political blowback from this. And then another thing to consider is that in the original plan, moving most future workers onto 401k style plans, it means there's no fresh blood, no new employees that are going into the old defined benefit pension system that would, and you need those new employees to continue to pump contributions into the system so that you can continue to pay retirees that are still in the system. So now that's part of why we see this change, the kind of reconsidering these defined benefit pension models, which is something the governor has said that he wants future workers to move on to 401k.
But Daniel, how far away has this moved from what Governor Bevin was originally proposing late last year?
It sounds like it's moved pretty far away from what he's proposing. I mean, we of course haven't seen the details yet. But one of the things that he really emphasized was that switching people over to the defined benefit plan, moving people over to that 401k style plan, because I think that this administration, they kind of see that as the direction for where they think state benefit plans are headed. And I think that they kind of saw this as an opportunity to kind of set a precedent for other states, and they wanted to take that opportunity. But with the legislature looking at having to balance this budget, looking at kind of austere budget cuts, they felt like they could justify moving people over to the defined benefit plan for that reason.
Yeah. So how exactly would this work? It'd be defined contribution plan, meaning the employee puts in their own money for anybody that's hired after a certain date. Is that how this would work?
Yeah, so it's a hybrid, right? It's a hybrid cash balance plan. So the employee puts in a little bit of money, and the employer puts in a little bit of money. And I mean, that's the most basic way of looking at it. I'm pulling something up, but Ryland might be able to help me out and explain it in more depth.
Yeah. the big difference actually between the normal defined contribution plan and this hybrid plan is that the state would guarantee a 4% return on investment into these accounts. So the state, whereas 401ks are kind of solely dependent on, how healthy the stock market is, whether these investments are growing, the state would set a baseline and say, all right, even in the worst years when the stock market's not doing well, we'll guarantee you a 4% return in your retirement account.
So currently the existing employees have been using they're on a defined benefit plan. Is that correct?
There's kind of there are three different tiers.
And that's where this whole thing gets sticky, right?
Yeah. So all teachers are in a defined benefit program. That means, they contribute a bit out of their checks, state contributes a bit out of their checks, and they're guaranteed a retirement benefit for the rest of their lives, after they retire. Some older state workers are in that kind of plan as well. Recently, 2013 was the last round of pension reforms, and so since then, new state employees have been put into that hybrid cash balance plan. So there's already some precedent for this sort of plan in Kentucky, and so I think that also, again, kind of going forward, we're still working on hints and innuendo of what's going to be in this new version. But it sounds like there's still going to be a defined benefit option for teachers, and it sounds like the hybrid cash balance will continue forward for some state employees, and then kind of 401ks will be optional.
So Kentucky's pension system, it's in bad shape. So Daniel, how much confidence is there that this is going to fix the problem?
So, I mean, I don't know whether or not. The biggest problem is the unfunded pension liability, right? There's this debt that Kentucky owes. And so the way that you solve that unfunded pension liability is by putting money into the pension system and allocating a lot of resources, allocating a lot of money, and trying to pay down that liability. So they are already committed to doing that. The governor's budget proposal, it put aside a lot of money toward pensions. And so they should be able to start paying off this thing. It'll take a lot of time, but they should start being able to pay this thing off. Now the question becomes, okay, how do we make sure that we're not digging this hole deeper? How do we make sure that this unfunded liability isn't going to get worse as we pay a lot of money towards the liability? And there's a question about this, right? So they see the hybrid cash balance plans. If they move new teachers to a hybrid cash balance plan, they see that as a way to save money in the long term. But some of the things that would save money in the short term, like freezing cost of living adjustments, or like making retirees pay more into the health account, and so that the state doesn't have to pay into their health retirement accounts, that type of stuff was enormously unpopular. And it was the stuff that would have saved money in the short term and would have made the amount that they have to pay towards this pension system in the short term a little bit less. And it doesn't look like those types of things are going to be in the bill. But again, hints and innuendos.
So the governor's committed to, that they're going to put more money into the pension systems, starting this year with this year's budget. And it's going to be this massive amount that's going to be larger than the state's ever put in. And really, it raises the question, which the governor has raised and others have raised, but there's not really the political willingness for it, of trying to find new sources of revenue in the state. Right now, kind of the only cost-saving method they're looking at is just cutting. The governor's proposed, eliminating 70 programs across state government, reducing state spending by 6.25%. But he and other people, they want the state to find some other way to make more money. That he said he wants to have this special session on tax reform. Again, hasn't been political willingness for it, but it just seems like it's more and more of a reality that something has to be done so the state can have more money to pay its obligation.
Ryland, how much time is left in the General Assembly?
We're a little over the halfway point. So the last day of the legislative session is April 13th, I believe. So we're a little over halfway. We still don't have a pension bill.
Is there any talk that there might not be a pension bill? Or are they pretty determined?
I think everybody's pretty determined to propose something. I think that political observers will say that, how is this going to happen? how are they going to pass any major changes to the pension system? And feel okay with that, with respect to voters, be able to do that without, while surviving the gauntlet of all these teachers and state employees who are really mad about tinkering with any sort of benefits. I think that all the lawmakers are very confident, but we just still haven't seen the path there. We haven't seen exactly how they're going to do it.
What would happen if they didn't pass pension reform in this GA?
The governor continues to threaten that the state is going to run out of money to pay out pension checks. I think that's probably a bit alarmist that would happen anytime soon. But I mean, the financial reality of this is that the main pension fund for most state workers only has 13% of the money it needs to pay out future checks. Other people argue that. Previous reforms, that last round of reforms in 2013, they've actually helped out the pension systems, and they're starting to tip upwards, especially with these increased contributions into the systems. There's possibility that they would be able to continue surviving along the pace that it's at. But again, beyond that, the state can't continue to afford putting all of this money into the pension systems unless it continues making really deep cuts into the systems and, or find some other source of revenue.
Daniel, any final thoughts from you?
I mean, I think he summed up the kind of situation right now is there is a real issue in terms of revenue in the state, and the leadership has been reluctant to say that they're going to raise taxes in any way, shape, or form. And so there's been a little bit of talk about, well, then do you start to cut loopholes? How do you start to make sure that the state's bringing in more money? But there haven't been any really serious discussions about it. And so for the time being, we're mostly just going to, I guess, be seeing cuts. And I know Governor Bevin has said that he really would like to see a special session on tax reform. He promised that last year, and again, he tried to re-up that and say that that's going to happen this year. There seems to not be a lot of inspiration and motivation to do big tax reform in the General Assembly because of the kind of political risks of doing it.
So, Daniel, there's also this proposal in the General Assembly now that's going to have an effect on unemployment benefits if it should pass. Tell us what this is about.
So there's this proposal to make changes to unemployment insurance, and that's basically your unemployment benefits. So say you were working and you got laid off, you're eligible to receive unemployment benefits for a certain period of time. Right now, there's a maximum of 26 weeks where you could receive retirement benefits, and the average benefit is around $322.48 a week. And this bill would change it so that it would limit how long workers can receive benefits based on the state's unemployment rate. And so it creates this threshold of basically every 0.5 percentage points that the unemployment rate goes up, you increase by a week. So if the unemployment rate is lower than 5.4%, then you're only eligible for 14 weeks of unemployment insurance. Right now, we're around like 4.4% unemployment in the state of Kentucky. And so that means that the average person currently, so right now the average person currently has 18.8 weeks of unemployment benefits. And so that means it would be chopped nearly in half for if this bill were to go into effect. So people would only be eligible for 14 weeks instead of that 18 weeks. It also raises the minimum income that a person has to have in order to qualify for those benefits. So that's going to cut out a lot of like part-time workers, people who aren't making as much money, that sort of thing. And then it freezes the maximum possible benefit that Kentucky workers can receive until it matches the average maximum benefit of all of Kentucky's border states. So if you wanted to like get an inflation rise in how much you can get in terms of your benefits for your unemployment insurance, that has to wait until all the other states catch up to where Kentucky is. Kentucky currently has the second highest maximum possible benefit out of the surrounding states. And states like Tennessee actually has a really low maximum possible benefit, so that drags the average down, which makes it harder. We're going to kind of be stuck at the same level for a long period of time. And so all of these things are going to make changes. And the big reason why some of the advocacy groups are really focused on this is because by using the statewide unemployment rate, you affect some of the struggling counties more than others. So, like,
in other words, places where it's tougher to get a job.
Exactly. So like in Harlan County, the unemployment rate is 10.8%, when the statewide unemployment rate is 4.4%. So the people in Harlan County, where it's harder to get a job, this is really, really tough on them. And so that's kind of what they're trying to raise awareness of that. And it seems like there's still support for this bill in the House. We'll just kind of have to see where it goes.
So where does it stand in the legislative process?
Last I checked, it has not been heard in committee yet, although it does have some support. This week, they were focused on a bill that would make changes to workers' compensation in the economic development in the committee where this bill would be heard. So it still has not been heard. But according to House Speaker Pro Tem David Osborne, there is a lot of support in the Republican caucus for this bill.
What changes are they talking about making in workers' compensation?
So in workers' compensation, basically the biggest change is that after 15, so right now if you get hurt on the job and you have a permanent partial disability, which means that, like, say you lost a finger, you can still work, but you don't have that finger anymore, you're eligible for lifetime benefits. What they want to do is they want to put a cap on that for new workers. So anybody who currently gets benefits, they'll be able to keep their benefits. But if you were to get hurt, say after this bill went into effect, if it passes, so July 1st, 2018, you would only be eligible for benefits 15 years after the date that you get hurt. Now, there's a two-year, you can re-up it every 2 years if you're continuing to need services. But if you let that lapse at all after 15 years, then you can't go back and re-qualify for the workers' compensation. The police officers and the firefighters, first responders, are really against this bill because they feel like it's going to limit how many people qualify for workers' compensation, and they think that they feel like it's unfair to first responders and police officers.
And finally, Daniel, Governor Matt Bevin's weighing in on a Kentucky Supreme Court case that involves a Lexington business, and from what I understand, the business refused to print T-shirts for an LGBT organization because of religious objections, and this has been making its way through the court system, and it's finally reached the state Supreme Court. And the governor is siding with the Lexington business, which I believe is Hands-On Originals. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, so Hands-On Originals, they refused to print the Lexington Pride Festival shirt back in 2012 because the owner said that he had religious objections to spreading the message that it's okay to take pride in being gay. And so he said, I'm not printing these shirts. The Lexington Human Rights Commission said that violated Lexington's fairness ordinance, and so they took him to court. It went to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals actually ruled in favor of the business, saying that he didn't necessarily have an issue with the individual. He wasn't discriminating against gay people because he didn't have an issue with what individual gay actions. He was actually opposed to the message that the LGBT group was trying to spread, and so it would have infringed on his rights because he did not want to spread that message. The governor, of course, now has weighed in, and he says that he supports the business, and he says that if they were to rule against the business, they would be violating the guy's freedom of consciousness, which they say is enshrined in the Kentucky Constitution. And so basically they're saying it's this religious freedom argument that this guy should have the religious freedom to say, no, I don't want to print the message that this LGBT group wants to send out.
Is it common for a governor to take a side in a case like this?
So friend of the court briefs, which is what he filed, it's just saying he supports it. It has happened in the past. I mean, he weighed in on, if you remember, there was a transgender ordinance. President Barack Obama said that schools had to allow transgender students to have access to a bathroom, and he weighed in on that one, saying that the president was overstepping. So it happens, right? And this is clearly an issue where he feels strongly about in terms of religious freedom. And so, yes, it does happen, and this is an issue where he's passionate.
Ryland and Daniel, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton, political writer for the Lexington Herald Leader Daniel DeRosier. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.